You could spend thousands of dollars and fly like 5,000 miles across the globe to reach an island like Rhodes, Greece, only to realize that your brain is doing the exact same thing it does on your Tuesday morning commute.
Right. Yeah, you're completely optimizing for speed.
Exactly. You are scanning for a parking spot near St. Paul's Bay. You're constantly checking your watch to see if you can squeeze in the Acropolis of Lindos before noon. And you're basically filtering out the actual physical environment just to hit your next waypoint.
It's a really fascinating psychological trap.
It is. We tend to treat vacations like a, well, like a logistical puzzle that needs to be solved as efficiently as possible.
Yeah, we often refer to it as travel fatigue, but it is really a symptom of cognitive overload. When we prioritize efficiency and volume in a new environment, our brains essentially stay locked in this low-grade fight or flight mode.
Wow, fight or flight,
Yeah.
just from sightseeing.
Right. Because you are navigating unfamiliar roads, you're managing schedules, you're dodging crowds, in that state, you aren't actually experiencing the destination. You are merely conquering an itinerary.
Just checking boxes.
Exactly. The environment becomes this blur of gift shops and photo ops because you just haven't given your sensory system the bandwidth to absorb anything deeper.
Which brings us to the core of our deep dive today. We are looking at a fundamentally different way to process an island environment, specifically through horseback riding along the coastal roads.
Yes.
The mission here is to explore how stepping out of the rental car and deliberately surrendering your pace to a horse actually rewires your biological and psychological experience of the whole destination.
It's a radical shift in perspective, really. I mean, think about the modern travel apparatus. A car, a tour bus, even a high-speed ferry. These are all designed to insulate you from the environment while moving you through it.
Oh, for sure, you're completely enclosed.
Right. You are protected from the temperature, the wind, the uneven ground.
It's almost like watching a highly produced documentary of a landscape while sitting inside a soundproof booth. I mean, you can see it, but you aren't physically implicated in it.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah, and getting into the saddle essentially shatters that glass. Suddenly, the wind isn't just something rustling the trees outside your window. It's a physical variable you feel on your skin. The topography of the ground dictates your balance. And the sound of the Aegean Sea isn't just background music fighting against the hum of an AC unit. It becomes your primary acoustic input.
And, that immersion is driven by a very specific biological mechanism.
Okay, tell me about that.
Well, when you are riding a horse at a walk, you are experiencing a bilateral rhythmic motion. And that specific cadence actually engages the human parasympathetic nervous system.
Wait, really? Just the walking rhythm.
Yeah, absolutely. It's physically lowers your heart rate, it drops your cortisol levels, and it forces your brain out of that anxious optimizing travel mode we talked about earlier. You are essentially borrowing the calm, steady baseline of the animal beneath you.
But that raises a pretty massive contradiction for me.
How so?
Because when most people hear the phrase horseback riding on a beach, the immediate visual is like this high-speed cinematic gallop, you know? You picture water splashing everywhere, hair blowing in the wind, racing down the shoreline like you're the star of some romance movie.
Oh, totally. The classic movie scene.
Right. But if the goal is lowering cortisol and engaging the parasympathetic nervous system, galloping down a crowded coastline seems entirely counterproductive.
It would be, which is exactly why these specific coastal routes in Rhodes are engineered completely differently. They are deliberately capped at a slower pace.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, the focus is entirely on the atmosphere, the natural trails, and the open sea views, rather than, high-octane equestrian stunts.
Because speed requires tunnel vision. If I'm galloping, I'd imagine my brain has to allocate almost all of its resources to balance mechanics and just analyzing the immediate 10 feet of terrain in front of me so I don't fall off.
Precisely. High speed demands a massive cognitive load. By removing the demand for speed and just maintaining a relaxed walking rhythm, your brain reallocates that bandwidth to your surroundings.
So you actually notice things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You suddenly have the mental capacity to notice the smell of wild thyme on the trail, the subtle gradient of the blue in the water, the rhythmic crunch of the hooves on the dirt. You absorbed significantly more of roads at 3 miles an hour than you ever could at 40 miles an hour.
So if the slow rhythm provides the mental bandwidth to appreciate the landscape, I guess the next variable is the landscape itself.
Right.
And a huge portion of this experience takes place on the East Coast. specifically around Afantu Beach.
Yes, that's a prime location.
Yeah, and this area is characterized by very long, uninterrupted shoreline, broad horizons, and a generally calm, sheltered topography. It is essentially a massive static canvas. But what completely blows my mind is how the exact same physical grains of sand can offer three entirely different psychological experiences based entirely on the rotation of the Earth.
It's true. The landscape is the constant, but the sun is the absolute dictator of the experience. We often underestimate how heavily the angle and quality of light govern human emotion.
Let's track that throughout the day. So if you take the morning ride on that East Coast route, the environment is described as incredibly crisp. Like the horizon feels endless.
It really does.
And from a scientific standpoint, that morning Mediterranean light is piercing the water at a steeper angle, which illuminates the depth and clarity of the sea in a way that just doesn't happen later in the day.
Right. And the morning ride leverages that visual and mental clarity. It triggers an energizing response.
Because it's cooler out.
Partly the temperature, yeah. The temperatures are cooler, the island hasn't fully woken up yet, and that sharp blue spectrum light naturally promotes wakefulness and forward momentum.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, it appeals directly to a traveler who is seeking a quiet, fresh reset before the heat and the crowds of midday sort of take over.
But if we fast forward to the sunset ride on that exact same stretch of beach, the entire emotional resonance flips. And this isn't just about pretty colors, right? This is Rayleigh scattering at work.
Ah, yes, Rayleigh scattering.
Yeah. As the sun dips lower, the light has to pass through more of the Earth's atmosphere, which scatters the shorter blue wavelengths and allows those longer red, orange, and golden wavelengths to hit the beach.
And that phenomenon physically alters our perception of the space. The golden hour doesn't just change the color of the water, it creates elongated shadows that add deep texture to the sand and the coastal vegetation.
So it feels richer visually.
Much richer. The landscape feels physically warmer. And biologically, as that light shifts into the warmer spectrum, our bodies begin signaling the early stages of melatonin production. We naturally begin to relax.
Which explains why that specific sunset window feels inherently more reflective or even romantic. You aren't just looking at a sunset. Your biology is actually syncing up with the fading of the day.
Exactly. And that transition continues right into the evening ride. Once the sun dips below the horizon, you lose that visual dominance entirely. The colors mute into twilight purples and deep blues.
And when you lose visual dominance, your other senses have to compensate.
They do.
I imagine the sound of the waves crashing on the Afantu shoreline becomes incredibly pronounced during an evening ride, simply because your brain isn't processing a blinding sunset anymore.
That's spot on.
It sounds like the ultimate decompression chamber after a chaotic day of touring ancient ruins.
It acts as a perfect sensory palate cleanser. It forces you to just exist in the fading ambient temperature, listening to the rhythm of the horse and the water. It's a brilliant example of how altering a single variable, just the time of day, completely rewrites the narrative of the exact same location.
Now, if the East Coast is defined by this broad, shifting canvas of light on a continuous beach, the other side of the island offers a completely different architectural structure to the experience.
Yes, the Northwest Coast.
Right. Moving over to the Northwest Coast, facing the Aegean Sea, the topography changes entirely.
Completely different vibe. The Aegean side of Rhodes sits in the path of the prevailing winds. It isn't sheltered in the same way the East Coast is.
So it's wilder?
Much wilder. The environment feels more rugged, more wind-shaped. The vegetation is hardier, and the terrain is less of a flat expanse and more of a structured coastal landscape.
So if the East Coast is like a single beautiful continuous camera shot sweeping across a beach, the Northwest sunset ride feels structurally more like a three-act play.
Oh, I like that analogy.
Yeah. Act one is terrestrial. You start inland at a working ranch. You are surrounded by the smells of earth and hay, meeting the animals.
Grounding you in the environment.
Exactly. Act two is the transition. You're navigating these natural brush-lined trails, moving through the actual ecosystem of the island. And then act three is the revelation. The trail suddenly breaks open, and you are presented with this massive dramatic sunset over the open Aegean Sea.
And the psychological value of that three-act structure is immense. In environmental psychology, there's a concept regarding how we value a view based on how we arrive at it.
Oh, like effort versus reward.
Precisely. On the East Coast, you are immediately presented with the beach. It is beautiful, obviously, but it is instantaneous. On the Northwest Coast, you have to earn the coastline.
You are building a narrative of anticipation.
Exactly. The transition through the inland trails builds a real sense of journey. When the landscape finally opens up to the water, the emotional payoff is significantly higher because of the contrast.
Right. Going from closed trails to open ocean.
Yes. You have moved from a closed terrestrial environment to an infinite aquatic horizon. This multi-layered approach creates a much stickier episodic memory than simply, you know, walking out of a hotel lobby and stepping onto the sand.
It is the difference between a stroll and an expedition, even if the physical exertion is minimal. But this multi-layered immersive journey raises a pretty massive red flag for me when we look at the practical details of this experience.
What's that?
Well, there is an option to include a short audio narration during these rides.
Mm.
And I have to be honest, handing me an audio headset while I'm trying to sync my nervous system with a horse on a rugged Asian cliff sounds like a terrible idea.
I can see why you'd think that.
Doesn't piping a recorded voice into my ear instantly shatter that fragile, unplugged immersion we just spent 20 minutes dissecting? It feels like bringing a museum docent into a meditation retreat.
That is a highly logical pushback, because our default association with an audio guide is like a monotonous historian reciting dates and dynasties while we stare passively at a ruin.
Exactly.
But that entirely mischaracterizes how audio is being deployed in this specific context.
So it isn't a 40-minute lecture on the Bronze Age collapse while my horse is trying to walk.
Far from it. First, it doesn't replace the human riding guide who is physically there, reading the horses and managing the flow of the group.
Okay, good.
The audio is actually designed as a spatial anchor. It is sparse, atmospheric context layered subtly over the experience. Its purpose isn't to distract you from the environment with heavy trivia. Its purpose is to draw your attention closer to the specific details of the landscape you might otherwise filter out.
Okay, I see the distinction.
Mm.
It is more like augmented reality.
That's a good way to look at it.
Like if I'm looking at a specific rock formation on that Northwest Trail, the audio isn't pulling me out of the moment to talk about a battle 1,000 miles away. It is giving me the context of what I am physically looking at, grounding me deeper into that specific square mile of road.
Exactly. It acts as an interpretive lens. When you understand a fraction more about the wind shaping the trees you are riding past, or the history of the specific bay you are looking at, the landscape stops being just pretty scenery and becomes a living environment.
It adds depth.
Right. It enriches the visual input without breaking the physical trance of the ride.
That makes a lot of sense. Knowledge as an enhancer of the present moment rather than an escape from it.
Precisely.
Well, let's talk about a few other practicalities, because the physical reality of sitting on an animal dictates certain preparations.
Mm-hmm.
For someone who has spent their life optimizing rental cars and has never been within 10 feet of a horse, how much of a barrier to entry is the riding itself?
The barrier to entry is essentially zero.
Really?
Never.
Truly. Because the core philosophy of these coastal routes is a slow, rhythmic pace, not an athletic challenge. They are fundamentally designed for absolute beginners. The horses are highly calibrated to this calm baseline.
Which means the preparation is less about equestrian skill and entirely about environmental readiness. We are talking closed-toe shoes.
Very important.
Right, not just a suggestion, but a mechanical necessity. If you're wearing sandals, you have zero stability in a metal stirrup, and frankly, you are exposing your feet to the friction of the trail.
The stirrup physics alone dictate a solid shoe, and clothing needs to facilitate movement without chafing. But the biggest environmental variable, going back to our earlier discussion on light, is exposure.
Right. If you choose the morning or late afternoon rides, you aren't just dealing with ambient sunlight.
Mm.
You are dealing with ultraviolet light reflecting directly off the surface of the Aegean or Mediterranean Sea.
Yes, the reflection is intense.
You're getting hit from above and below. Sun protection isn't just about comfort. It is about mitigating a very harsh environmental reality.
Conversely, if you opt for the evening ride, the thermodynamics of the coast completely flip.
Because it cools down.
Right. As the land cools rapidly after sunset, it draws the sea breeze inward. A landscape that felt oppressive at 2 in the afternoon can induce shivers by 8 at night.
Wow, quite the swing.
It is. Bringing a light layer of clothing is the only way to ensure you can actually focus on the sound of the waves rather than your own discomfort.
So synthesizing all of this, the biology of the rhythm, the physics of the light, the topography of the coast, if someone listening is staring at their roads itinerary right now, trying to figure out how this fits into their travel puzzle, it seems the choice is entirely dependent on what psychological state they want to engineer.
I agree completely. It is about auditing your own travel style. What do you actually need from your afternoon?
Let's break it down. If you are the type of traveler who suffers from crowd fatigue, who craves sharp clarity and wants to feel the island before the heat bakes the landscape, you align yourself with the East Coast morning ride.
Yes. You are choosing the crispest, most energizing version of the environment.
And if you prioritize visual drama, if you want that deep, resonant warmth that shifts your biology into a relaxed, reflective state, the East Coast sunset ride is the obvious mechanism.
Without a doubt.
Now, if your itinerary has been brutal, you've been walking on cobblestones for 10 hours, and you just need a sensory deprivation chamber to wash the noise away.
Yeah.
You book the East Coast evening ride to let the sound of the ocean dominate.
Exactly. And if you require a narrative arc, if you want to earn the view through transition, moving from the enclosed ranch trails out to the wilder, wind-shaped Ajin Coast, you choose the Northwest Journey.
Because it's the full package.
Right. It is the most structurally complete adventure.
It is brilliant how customizable the psychological outcome is simply by shifting the geography by a few miles or the clock by a few hours.
Ultimately, the underlying value here has nothing to do with horses or beaches.
What do you mean?
It is a lesson in relinquishing control of our pace. We live in an era governed by speed, efficiency, and information overload, and we inevitably carry that sickness into our vacations.
We really do. We rush to accumulate experiences.
Exactly. But when you get into the saddle, you are forced to yield your frantic human pacing to the deliberate biological rhythm of an animal.
Mm-hmm.
It demands that you stop merely visiting a backdrop and start physically inhabiting the environment.
That is incredibly well said. Yeah. And, you know, it leaves you with a fascinating question to consider long after the trip is over. If consciously changing our physical pace from 40 miles an hour in a car down to 3 miles an hour on a horse can completely alter our perception of a Greek island. How much of our everyday lives back home, our own neighborhoods, our own morning commutes, are we entirely blind to, simply because of the speed at which we insist on moving through them?